Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the Nazi-Soviet Pact of 1939, its origins, the factors that prompted it into existence, and really the implications, the aftershock of this treaty. By 1936, Stalin had three countries in mind as the greatest threats to the Soviet Union: Germany, Poland and Japan. And he was convinced there was some sort of policy of encirclement going on around his borders. The reason he was particularly concerned about the Poles, I mean, ironically the Poles presented next to no military threat to him, but he had long bitter memories of 1920. In 1919, Poland had tried to seize the east of Ukraine. It seemed an ideal opportunity. The Soviet Union was in chaos. The Polish state was founding itself just after the Treaty of Versailles. And there were ethnic Poles in eastern Ukraine. So the Polish government under Marshal Pilsudski saw it as an opportunity to seize that territory and expand the borders of Poland as east, as far east as possible, and wait for the Versailles peacemakers to have their verdict and hopefully help defend these borders in future. The Red Army fought back and pushed the Polish invaders out of Ukrainian territory, marching all the way to the gates of Warsaw, where they were crushed by Pilsudski's armies. And the Red Army in Poland was virtually annihilated. The two political commissars that went with the Soviet generals were Stalin and Trotsky, and both of them bickered between the other as to who was responsible for the disaster. Soviet security forces throughout the 1920s and 30s were obsessed with this porous border that existed between Ukraine and Poland, convinced that Polish saboteurs and spies were crossing over from time to time to cause unrest amongst the Ukrainian peasants, who in the 1930s obviously are victims of famine and are pretty resentful towards the Soviet authorities themselves without any help from the Poles. And in the conspiracy theory is that Poland was attempting to find clever ways to detach Ukraine again, perhaps the Ukrainian uprising, and have the ethnically Polish Ukrainians attach their part of Ukraine to Poland. Obviously, all works of fantasy. So, as far as Japan went, Japan was the main anti-communist power in the East. And once again, it was the Soviet Union's porous borders that made Stalin yet more suspicious of the Japanese, other than the fact that the Japanese had not only defeated Russia in 1905, but also been part of the Allied anti-Soviet invasion of 1919 to 21. The Japanese had lingered around until about 1922, and they'd seen really, they'd been rather keen on annexing a large chunk of Siberia for themselves. The Japanese government had even handed out posters to its people and postcards and flyers saying, "Come to the wonderful new territory of Siberia, it'll be great." Or, you know, I paraphrase, but words to that effect. During the Soviet famines, the attempt to collectivise not just the Ukrainians, but the Kazakh nomads had catastrophic effects upon them. The nomads survived through having a migratory pattern across the border into China, the Western China, and back into the Soviet Union again. And Stalin's reading of that was that China was now Japan's fiefdom, and therefore these Kazakhs were probably Japanese spies. Again, this is, pure paranoia. But it wasn't simply Stalin's paranoia. It was a wide-ranging paranoia that you can see in the top echelons of the Soviet government, all the way down to the lowest rungs, and widespread throughout the Soviet population. A couple of weeks ago, I was extolling the virtues of Sheila Fitzpatrick's Everyday Stalinism, and the exploration of Soviet paranoia is quite well done there. It's well worth a read. I suppose the reason for this degree of paranoia was the fact that the Soviet Union was a revolutionary society. It was a society born of a revolution that evidently a great deal of the world's powers wanted to put down. And so much of the paranoia that you see emerging is similar to the kind of sentiments expressed in the years after the French Revolution, when France is fighting its revolutionary wars, which are in large part, to start with, wars of national survival, and the survival of the revolution, which is, at that point, you know, the expression of nationhood. And, of course, the third power, Germany, Stalin looks at and astutely observes that there may be trouble coming from Hitler. Stalin's understanding of Hitler was an interesting one. Stalin looked at Hitler and thought, oh, this anti-Semitism stuff, that's nothing, that's just a front, that's just, you know, talk. He doesn't really believe this, he doesn't really have racial theory at the heart of his empire. What Hitler's all about, really, Hitler is a front man for capitalists. They have put him up there, and they are the guys that are pulling the strings. So we don't need to appeal to Hitler per se if we want to appease him and buy him off. We need to be talking to the capitalists that we think are behind him. And this, as I'll show later on, really shapes much of Stalin's thinking when it comes to making a deal with Nazi Germany. So Stalin looks from about 1936 onwards at the world situation and sees that there is, you know, the likelihood of what he views as being an anti-Soviet war in the offing. And his one of the main reasons for the purges from sort of 36 to 38 are that he believes that a lot of necessary work needs to be done in Russia to prepare Russia for war. So you need to root out the traitors, root out the fifth columnists, root out those that will rise up in support of the invading enemy to overthrow your regime as quickly as possible. And there does seem to be a great deal of emphasis on getting the killings done in as time-efficient manner as possible. The degree of organisation of the purges, the various levels of the purges, is interesting, not only because a great deal of it is centralised and handed down and set out in quotas, but also the quotas are expected to be reached and breached. Now, there's various reasons for that. It's not simply about the urgency, and we'll come on to that perhaps another time. One of the victims of the Stalinist purges is the officer corps, going from junior officers, lieutenants and captains, all the way through to the middle ranks, all the way up to the senior ranks, and even seeing some of the most celebrated and the most important military thinkers in the USSR executed. One of the greatest errors that Stalin ever perpetrated was the execution of Marshal Tukhachevsky. Tukhachevsky was one of the foremost military thinkers of the interwar era and believed in this idea of deep operations, of having armed spearheads pushing deep into enemy territory and encircling armies. And who read this book? The likes of Guderian, the likes of Manstein, and the senior German generals who crafted the German strategies of Blitzkrieg. So the execution of Tukhachevsky, based purely on Stalinist paranoia and Tukhachevsky's unfortunately noble background, was a total error of judgment. And by 1939, Stalin is painfully aware of how vulnerable his purges have left the Soviet Union. On the face of things, Nazi Germany could not have been a more unlikely signatory of a pact with Stalin. Not only in 1936 was it joined with Italy and Japan in the Anti-Comintern Pact, an aggressive military alliance with the clear focus on the Soviet Union, but also Hitler had been giving aid to the rebels in Spain under General Franco, and Stalin had been supporting the Republic. It's a popular idea that what Stalin wanted was for the Republic to triumph and for fascism to be defeated in Spain. But I think a more likely picture is that Stalin didn't care about what happened to the Republic. He looked to be creating a long, drawn-out civil war which Hitler could be dragged into for hopefully a decade, and perhaps even longer. It could have been Hitler's Vietnam, and thus be bogged down, and thus not be able to pay any attention to Russia in the long run. To explain the Nazi-Soviet pact, one has to, unfortunately, think a bit like Stalin. Stalin was an astute judge in many ways, a paranoid in others, but quite astute in some, in looking at what was happening in the West, and looking at appeasement in particular. Not only did he assume, with some degree of justification, that appeasement was merely designed to send Hitler east instead of engaging him in the West.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
But he also assumed that if that wasn't the case, then there seemed to be no fighting qualities left in the British and French, and that there was no strength among their political classes to take Hitler on. And therefore, Stalin had little faith that there would be any chance of a united front against Hitler, particularly when the Popular Front government in France ceases to exist. In early 1939, after the Munich Agreement, Stalin puts out feelers to the West to see if there is the likelihood of any kind of diplomatic initiative occurring, but is strongly rebuffed by the British government that loathes Soviet communism, perhaps even more than they distrust and fear Nazism. The result is that Stalin considers that he might be able to play the West at their own game and make an agreement with Hitler first, thus putting the West in the firing line long before Stalin is. Stalin's well aware that a war with Nazi Germany will come at some point. He hopes that a rerun of World War I might happen, that the British and the French will get bogged down with Germany in France, and that will give Stalin time to rebuild his armed forces and to undo the errors that he's made with his generals, and to build a defence industry that he was really working on throughout the five-year plans that will help to create a very formidable Soviet Union. And the Germans look at the Soviet Union and they think, and they can see that happening. They think, well, you know, we need to, if we're going to do the Soviet Union, we need to do it in the next year or two. Because in 5 years, they will be not only too powerful to attack, but they will be sufficiently powerful to sweep across Western Europe. And one of the things that the Nazis, and particularly the SS, viewed themselves as was the kind of the anti-communist vanguard, the anti-communist kind of knights, Teutonic knights, who would be Europe's last line of defence against the Bolsheviks and the Jews that seemed to be controlling them, etc., etc. So there was a sense of urgency on the Nazis' side as well. Traditionally, Germany has always sought to avoid wars on two fronts. It's something that was a centre point of Bismarck's strategy in the latter quarter of the 19th century, and it was a main failing of Wilhelmine diplomacy that a war in two fronts was possible at all, and that Russia felt sufficiently alienated in 1914 to have relations with one of its most loathed adversaries, Britain. So from that point of view, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact makes sense, the Nazi-Soviet Pact, that is, signed by Joachim von Ribbentrop and Vyacheslav Molotov, the foreign ministers from both countries. The ability to divide the Western allies from the Soviet Union Hitler viewed the later combination of the two as this kind of rather ludicrous chimera of oligarchic capitalists with Bolshevik Jewry. And the common conclusion he came to is like, well, the Jews were behind both. It might probably have disappointed Hitler to learn that Stalin was quite the anti-Semite himself. So in April of 1939, the Nazis put out feelers to the Soviets to suggest to them that there is a pact on the table, if possibly they want it. And it's probably a far better deal than the Western Allies can offer. Stalin is probably quite relieved at this and thinks that this is going to buy him some time. The first diplomatic gesture from Ribbentrop is that there should be a 100-year non-aggression treaty between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. And Stalin dismisses this, you know, in his inimitable, slightly casual style, says, no, this is nonsense. And instead, he proposes a 15-year non-aggression pact. And Stalin puts Molotov in charge of the discussions, getting rid of, or moving sideways, Maxim Litvinov, who was Jewish, and Stalin suspected this would offend his guests visiting in Moscow. Underpinning the negotiations is a gigantic trade deal. Now, Stalin believed that this would be the sweetener to Germany's capitalist classes. This is the thing that would stop them from invading. If the capitalist classes of Germany could receive cut-price timber, coal, steel, iron ore, manganese, and whatever else they required that was currently being provided by the vast Gulag archipelago across Russia, then they would be far less inclined to invade the Soviet Union and far more inclined to really allow the situation to continue ad infinitum. From Stalin's reading of Marx, the thing that capitalists are interested in more than anything else is profit, and if you can have that without conquest, so much the better. This, of course, will help Stalin buy time. What he doesn't understand is that when Hitler talks about racial rhetoric, about Lebensraum, about the Slavs being Untermenschen and all that, he means it. He's deadly serious. And this is, one of the great misapprehensions of Stalin. This is perhaps one of the reasons why, when the Soviet Union is invaded in 1941, that Stalin is so taken aback and so surprised and so stunned at his miscalculation. And the pact, of course, contained a secret protocol. It contained a secret protocol on the division of Poland that, once hostilities broke out in September 1939, that the two powers would cut Poland in two, and that the Nazis would take Western Poland and the Soviets would take the East. And there was a clear drawn-up boundary. The world that the Poles inhabited after that was one where there was not only the genocidal violence that we're familiar with in the West, this has been very well documented, but also class-based mass killing in the East of almost equivalent proportions, and one where the NKVD and Gestapo officers periodically met and swapped notes and helped one another over a two-year period. Stalin also allowed for German submarines and refueling ships to harbour in northern Soviet ports and bases. And he expressed in some degree of kind of ambiguity, but not ambiguity, if you can read between the lines of what Stalin is saying, a hope that the enemies of the Third Reich would be destroyed. And if in the future there was the opportunity for Stalin to lend a hand, well, maybe in that instance the Soviet Union would. So these are interesting and dangerous times. And during the second conflict that the Soviet Union would engage itself in that year, over the winter of 1939 to 1940, which was the invasion of Finland, which was a Soviet objective for some time, the British looked to that conflict and wondered whether they would have to take on in the Second World War both Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union as well. Other smaller states like the Baltic states and Bessarabia in northern Romania became very vulnerable to the Soviet Union were annexed largely as a result of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and the failure of the Soviets to conquer Finland. Their defeat was largely a result of the damage that Stalin had done to the army during the purges. The failure of the Finland campaign, the Winter War, led the Nazis, to conclude that really there was little fight left in the Soviet Union anyway. I think Hitler used the term that the Soviet Union was like a rotting edifice and one good kick on the door and the whole thing would come crashing down. This was obviously a rather optimistic verdict on the Soviet Union, who quickly learned from their mistakes and applied the failings that they had learned from to the defeat of the Nazis after 1941. Okay, well, that's just a quick run through of the Nazi-Soviet Pact. Now, I have written an ebook on this very subject, Hitler, Stalin, and the Destruction of Poland. So if you'd like to know some more about this, there's a link below this podcast and you can go straight to get the ebook and download it. A scintillating read, getting some great reviews as well, if I dare say so myself. Next week we'll be looking at the counterculture in the United States during the 1960s and a host of other fascinating topics, and prepare yourselves for the all-new extra feature-length Explaining History Review podcast next week. There'll be some interesting new features I'm sure you'll love. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. Bye-bye.